Broward voters will have the chance to pick a new state attorney for the first time in decades. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Mike Satz has held his post as Broward state attorney for four decades. Now, there are 10 candidates who want the job. We'll let you know who they are. Also, Sarah Faulkner is one of only a few women to make the Coast Guard's elite swim rescue team. She saved 48 people in one night in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Now, she's retired, and she's sharing her story of years of harassment and assault from her leaders.
He grabbed me by my head and licked me from my, basically my collarbone all the way up the side of my face, and then would just walk away laughing.
Finally, the Miami Marlins returned to play after being forced to quarantine half their team. Why did so many players get COVID? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Changes are coming in Broward County's leadership within the criminal justice system. State Attorney Mike Satz is leaving the position after 44 years in office. There are 8 Democrats vying in this August primary for the position. Their experiences vary from spending time in the Obama administration to working as a high school teacher to spending years under Satz himself. The Sun Sentinel's editorial board spent 2 hours getting to know all of the candidates, and although their platforms differ greatly, one thing is for certain. The person elected in November will fundamentally change the office. Sun Sentinel columnist Steve Bosquet joins us now. Steve, great to have you back.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
So Mike Satz has been in position for 4 decades. What is the legacy that he's leaving behind in the Broward State Attorney's Office?
Yes, Mike Satz became state attorney in 1976. Just parenthetically, Luis, I began my reporting career in Fort Lauderdale in 1981, which was a long time ago. And Satz was already entrenched by then. It's fair to say that he's had a very controversial record. He is a tough-on-crime guy. He's a strong believer in capital punishment for violent offenders, capital crimes, of course. Mike has always been sort of a not a very overt, extroverted sort of a personality. He never really took to the whole, rough and tumble of a political campaign. He's an attorney. He's a prosecutor and has had a prosecutor's approach to things. So he sent a lot of people to death row. Broward County, however, leads the state in the number of wrongful incarcerations, that is, sentences reversed because of new evidence. And so it's been 44 years, and I know you want to get to the new crop of candidates here, and it's important to note that four of the 8 Democrats who are running in the primary were not even born yet when Mike Satz became state attorney.
So basically, we're just pointing out the fact that, again, he's been in that office a very long time. You know, for those people who are unfamiliar, just remind us the significance of the state attorney's office and their role in criminal justice.
Sure. We've gone back and forth on this issue with the editorial board and with our readers about which is a more important election in terms of charting the future. Is it state attorney or sheriff? Because Broward has a very contentious race for sheriff, as people know. But I think this time it is state attorney because the office has been in the same hands for so long. You know, police locally or the sheriff's office or any agency arrest people and charge people with crimes. But the decision to prosecute and to take that case to trial rests with the state attorney's office. They're the prosecuting arm of the criminal justice system. And so they are the ones who decide, whether to seek the death penalty in a case. They are responsible for, helping to keep the streets safe in Broward County. And the state attorney plays an important role. Again, much criticized under Mike Satz's tenure, they're the responsible party mainly for prosecuting public corruption, people who hold elective office.
And, I mean, you talk about, you can go over so many cases that obviously in this very long career that he has taken on, probably one of the biggest, or at least the most current, is the Parkland shooter trial. Is he going to continue to pursue that once he leaves office?
Well, the answer to that depends on who wins the election. But several of the candidates have expressed a willingness to bring Mike Satz back or keep him on the staff of the state attorney's office as sort of as a special prosecutor, as it were, to prosecute Nicholas Cruz, the accused Parkland shooter. The argument that they make is that it is such a complex case, it is expected it's going to take months to impanel a jury. It's going to be an extremely difficult and painful experience, not only for the families, of course, of the victims, but for just about everyone in Broward County to have to relive this horrible tragedy. And the feeling, I think, is in legal circles that Satz knows the case so well, and it would provide continuity. It's important to note, though, that Mike Satz is a strong proponent of the death penalty. Different people, including the public defender's office in Broward, have proposed a life without parole for the Parkland shooter, but Satz believes in seeking the death penalty in this case.
All right. So the Sun Sentinel editorial board spent a couple of hours with the candidates before the primary. What was your initial reaction to the field of candidates and the kind of change that they would bring? What jumped out?
What jumped out is they're all very conscientious people. Some of them are, I would say, very liberal, very far left on the spectrum ideologically. There are candidates in this race who want to end cash bail for misdemeanors because they feel that it is just fundamentally unjust that people are stuck in the Broward County Jail for weeks, months, years because they can't pay $500 to bail themselves out. There are people in the race who oppose mass incarceration. I would say that it's fair to say that race is an important issue in this campaign. Two of the candidates of the eight are African American, but a really strong element of the discussion in front of our editorial board was the issue that if you just look at who's in the courthouse on any given day being arraigned, and it's disproportionately people of color. Are the people accused of crimes and who are the ones being prosecuted for crimes in Broward County.
And how has the Black Lives Matter protest shaped their platforms or impacted their perspectives?
It's had a profound effect, I would say. There are several candidates in this race who put that at the top of their agenda, that there are parts of their platform that have to do with holding the police much more accountable, and being much more of a sort of a watchdog on law enforcement. And that's going to be tricky because the way the criminal justice system works, of course, is that the police and the prosecutors, work hand in hand on cases to prosecute crimes, and it's the public defender's office that actually represents the accused.
Yeah.
So there is big change coming philosophically, regardless of who wins this race.
Again, I'm talking with the Sun Sentinel, Steve Bosquet. We are discussing the eight candidates currently running for the office of Broward State Attorney. You could read more of Steve's reporting about this race on our social media at WLRN Sundial. All right, now there's 10 candidates altogether, actually, eight Democrats. That's the primary, one Republican, one non-party affiliate. We're going to shoot through these eight candidates real quickly here. So I'm going to tell voters, you got to do your research. But let's go ahead and look at these eight candidates and briefly their platforms. Joe Kimmock, I hope I'm saying that right. He's landed some high-profile endorsements.
Right. I would say Joe Kimmock is probably the most progressive candidate in the race. He's one of the youngest candidates. He's a defense attorney from Weston. And he does. He has the support of Bernie Sanders in this race. Joe has never run for public office before, and he was the candidate who was most vocal in opposing the continuation of cash bail.
Mm. Teresa Fanning Williams, she ran against Satz 4 years ago, and actually it was a pretty close race.
It was. Teresa Fanning Williams has a real shot here because she has run countywide before. She is a career prosecutor who has spent many years in the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office. She was highly critical in our interviews of Mike Satz's record. She feels he takes too many questionable borderline cases to trial, too many weak cases, and she would change that dramatically and instantaneously if she got elected state attorney.
David Kennedy was an assistant state attorney for a number of years, and he spent some time in D.C.
He has. David Kennedy emphasized the need for stronger reentry programs, which basically don't exist in Broward County. There are lots of diversion programs to keep people out of the jail system, but Kennedy is a proponent of helping people charged with crimes after they've done the time, readjust to civil society. He's one of the youngest and least experienced candidates in this race.
You got a few candidates actually that have experience under SATs. You have Justin McCormick, Sarah Nell Murphy, and Harold Pryor. What are their relationships to SATs, and is he supporting any of them?
Yes, Mike Satz supports Sarah Nell Murphy, who I'd have to say is probably one of maybe three of the leading candidates in this race. Just based on, I'm emphasizing, there's almost no polling that's reliable here. This is based on word of mouth and slate cards and endorsements and the money raised and things like that. Sarah Nell Murphy has been in the state attorney's office for a very long time. She's one of the people I mentioned who would keep Mike Satz on to prosecute the Parkland case. She is an experienced hand. You know, she is the candidate that the Sun Sentinel endorsed in this race. It was a difficult call. We did a lot of time with all eight of these candidates, as you mentioned. And Murphy has the experience, and we felt, you know, strikes the right balance between a promising change, and she'd be much more visible and much more connected to the community than Mike Satz has been. But keeping in mind, the state attorney has a constitutional obligation, you know, to prosecute alleged wrongdoing and to provide public safety.
Just a couple other ones here. Joshua Rydell, he leads in fundraising. How did he do it?
Yeah, well, Josh Rydell is the vice mayor of Coconut Creek. You know, it's a suburban community in northwest Broward, and he's very young, but he's well-established in the political network. He's gotten on a lot of these slate cards, these palm cards. He's been an effective fundraiser. He has the support of Mark Bogan, a county commissioner, who's an important person to have in West Broward. Largely on the strength of fundraising, and I don't want to overemphasize it, but during this pandemic, the people are so, you know, there's a sense of disorientation because all the forums have been virtual and Zoom calls and so forth. Voters haven't had the usual opportunity to size up the candidates in person, but Rydell is a very polished guy for a young candidate, and I think he has he's a serious contender here.
And then finally, Jim Lewis, the eldest of the pack, he has the most experience. What about his campaign?
Well, you know, Jim Lewis you're right. He's 62 years old. He's been a former statewide prosecutor. He's been a defense attorney in Broward for a long time. But certainly in the legal community, far and away the best known candidate. He's also run for office at least half a dozen times, all unsuccessfully. Jim Lewis, struck this balance that I mentioned before, as did Murphy, with tempering the idea that we need reform and we need a more assertive, community-oriented prosecutor, but we also need to keep in mind the public safety responsibilities of the office.
Let me finish with this briefly. Broward County, I mean, it's not just this. They're going to have a new state attorney. They're also going to have a new public defender. So with the defender, the sheriff, the state attorney, how do you see the criminal justice system changing in Broward County after this year?
Well, I think what we're going to see is we're going to see something that's been in needed for a long time, and it's just sort of the elections catching up with the demographic changes in the community. Broward is a majority-minority community. And, even whoever wins this race is going to have to be much more mindful of that and of the fact that there are these disproportionate imbalances in terms of the racial disparities in prosecution. And that's going to have to become center on the agenda. The other thing we're going to see quickly is we're going to see, I think, regardless of who wins this election, I think we're liable to see less of a reliance and less of an emphasis on capital punishment. That was a part of Sasse's agenda, but I don't think it will be going forward.
So when we say this is a big election, a lot is going to change. Again, Sun Sentinel Steve Bosquet, and you can check out his reporting on our social media. Also, don't forget, we've included a link for the two-hour forum that was hosted by the League of Women Voters and the ACLU, so you can get to know the candidates, again, at WLRN Sundial. Steve, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks very much.
And again, keep yourself informed before you place that vote. Well, still to come, Sarah Faulkner was one of a few women who made it to the Coast Guard Elite Swim Rescue Team. She'll discuss her years of fighting to save lives in the water while fighting harassment from within the ranks. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Sarah Faulkner is the first woman to graduate from the Coast Guard's Helicopter Rescue Swimmer School and join the elite group. As an aviation survival technician first class, she went on countless missions, dropping down from helicopters to save people in dangerous waters. She gained national attention for her heroic rescues of 48 people from flooded waters in the course of one night after Hurricane Katrina. But during her 20 years of service, she also endured a much different challenge, regular sexual harassment and assault from her superiors. Her story highlights systemic problems within the Coast Guard Academy and has given a voice to other members who have come forward to tell their own stories of harassment, assault, and retaliation. McClatchy's Kevin G. Hall has brought those stories into the spotlight through an investigative series, and you can find it on our social media at WLRN Sundial. We reached out to the Coast Guard for comment on this story and received a lengthy statement. We'll post the statement in its entirety on our website later today, but here's an edited portion of their comments. Quote, "Eliminating sexual assault and harassment in the military is a top priority at every level in the Coast Guard. Everyone has a responsibility to foster a service culture of trust, respect, and dignity, a culture that will not accept sexual assault or its enabling behaviors." End quote. Faulkner is now retired in West Palm Beach. She joined us earlier this week to share her story. A note to parents, some of the themes discussed in the interview are difficult. Be mindful of your children.
I knew that I wanted to be a rescue swimmer for the Coast Guard in my teens in high school. And I found out about the Coast Guard and rescue swimmers actually by going on a trip on a naval aircraft carrier and talking to the Navy rescue swimmers, and they told me, don't join the Navy. If you want to be a rescue swimmer, join the Coast Guard. And then I looked into it, went on a training with the Coast Guard up in Northern California, and that was it. I was sold. But also, one of the younger rescue swimmers who was kind of cocky made a point to tell me that there were no females who had ever made it through the rescue swimmer school and that none probably ever would. And right then and there, I said, well, you just told that to the wrong person.
So it was the late 1990s when you joined the Coast Guard and there were no women that were part of the team. Were you ever given a reason why?
Well, the reason why there were no female rescue swimmers is because none of them had made it through our helicopter rescue swimmer school. We had three women make it and become rescue swimmers, but that is before the Coast Guard had our own rescue swimmer school. We used to use the Navy's rescue swimmer school. So I am the first female to make it through the Coast Guard's Rescue Swimmer School, and that was open for about 12 or 15 years before any woman had made it through, and that was me.
What are some of the types of rescues that you do when you're one of the rescue swimmers?
Well, we're always on watch, kind of like a fire department, so there's always a crew that's ready to go. And, you know, if the bell goes off, then we, you know, we go to the helicopter, and this could be anything. It could be a boat that lost its power and it's about to get smashed up on the rocks, so you need to hurry up and get those people off that boat as soon as possible. They could be way out to sea and their boat is sinking. It could be on fire. They could be caught in horrible weather. They could be injured. It could be more of a medevac. We do a lot of medevacs off of cruise ships. Well, and then you guys, I'm sure, have all seen us during the hurricanes and stuff. That's kind of a new thing for us ever since Hurricane Katrina kind of made us famous for that.
Yeah, and you know, that was one of the ones I wanted to ask you about, because you were recognized in the national media for your rescue missions during Katrina. What happened?
I was stationed in Mobile, Alabama. I was part of a flight crew that evacuated our helicopters, and we went to the Navy base in Jacksonville, Florida. And we were there watching the news. You know, Jacksonville, it was just like a beautiful, sunny Florida day. You would have never known that there was this hurricane barreling down. And at that point, we still didn't know where it was going to go. It was just coming straight for Mobile, and it could have went east and hit Pensacola or west to New Orleans. We were all basically staring at the weather, wondering where it was going to go. So then it hits New Orleans. We get a phone call that says, come back now, people are dying. So we actually rode the tail of the hurricane back into Mobile, and the pilots were so busy flying because they were dodging tornadoes. When you're in that kind of storm, there's like mini storms going on in there. I mean, it was dangerous, but, you know, getting caught in a tornado would have been way worse. And it was a very, very bumpy ride. When we landed, you could see the damage that had happened to our air station. Our helicopter just got taken by another crew. They took off that night and started doing rescues. I went home. I didn't sleep a wink. I had the radio on, and I just kept thinking of all those people. And I got a phone call really early in the morning, and they said, we need you now. And I was like, good, because I'm wide awake. So driving back to the air station, getting on a helicopter. I actually went to Mississippi that morning, and you know, New Orleans gets all the attention for that hurricane, but Mississippi got annihilated. There was 35-foot storm surge, so people's houses that got destroyed, all of that debris was up in the trees. So you would see like a hooded sweatshirt and go, oh, there's somebody, and then, you know, it was just clothes. All the boats from the marinas and stuff and the docks got washed into neighborhoods, and people were on those boats calling us on their radios and asking for help. So finding those people was actually kind of like finding a needle in a haystack.
And it was about 50 people that you rescued in that one night, right?
Well, this was the first day. And then the next day is actually when I did, yeah, it was 48 people. And that was in New Orleans.
So when you think about it, I mean, you had the time in Mississippi, right? And then then in Louisiana. I mean,
yeah.
What do you think about when you look back on that, the type of, and I know it's part of the training, but at the same time, it's almost superhuman, the stamina that you need physically and emotionally to handle that. What do you think about when you look back on that?
It really does come down to the type of person that makes it through rescue swimmer school. It's not all just about your swimming ability or how physically strong you are. You can be a great swimmer and, you know, be this big muscle-bound guy and quit. It comes down to your mental strength or your, you know, your intestinal fortitude or whatever you want to call it, combined with our excellent training. So the two of those together are what make U.S. Coast Guard rescue swimmers the best. When everything does go wrong or could go wrong, that rescue swimmer can still stay calm, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is from an outsider's perspective, as much as it makes sense to me. So, again, you get a lot of attention after that.
Yes.
And how did the leadership in the Coast Guard react to all of that media recognition that you were getting?
A lot of people got a lot of recognition. You know, some people met the president. You know, everybody was meeting the governor and stuff when we were getting medals. I got nominated for Glamour Magazine Woman of the Year, which was awesome. But then the rescue swimmers in my shop, not all of them. I had a lot of really great friends, but there were some that were just total jerks. And they were talking bad about that, like, she's going to, you know, only because she's a girl. It's like, well, do you want to be Glamour Magazine Woman of the Year? Like, I'm the only female rescue swimmer that did this in the world. So anyway, my command actually was great in Mobile, and they actually had my back. But the supervisors in my shop were terrible, just like all the other ones.
Yeah. You know, I think about your story, and I always think about that movie with Demi Moore when she, you know, was G.I. Jane, when she tried to be a Navy SEAL. And
yes,
the horrible, you know, treatment she got, because it was almost like, how dare you as a woman come into this world. From your story, I gathered that you ran into people who had that sort of attitude.
Yes, I can totally relate to that movie. Just basically take out the combat element of it, and it was kind of the same, really. It was. When I was at Rescue Swimmer School, there was blatant attempts for the instructors to do stuff to me that was so obvious that they were trying to get me to quit. And I couldn't say anything. I couldn't complain. I didn't have any proof, because they could just say, oh, well, no, you needed this. But when you're a class of five and only the female is getting her, for lack of a better term, her ass handed to her in the water, and the rest of them are just standing there resting in the shallow end. Like, what do you, you know, like,
and
what do you do? What do you say?
You're talking about, again, when you're trying to make the team.
Yes. So that's what I'm saying. It reminds me of when she was going through her training, too, because they just did not. Some of the instructors did definitely resent me, and they didn't want me to make it.
I'm speaking with Sarah Faulkner. She spent years working with the U.S. Coast Guard as part of the Elite Swimmer Rescue Team. She was one of only three women to ever become part of the team, and she experienced systemic sexual abuse and harassment throughout her time in the Coast Guard. You can read more of Sarah's story written by McClatchy's Kevin G. Hall on our social media at WLRN Sundial. You mentioned how at the beginning, you know, you were told, don't bother, you know, there's no women here. And you took that as a challenge.
Yeah.
When did you start to experience that abuse, that sexism from supervisors and colleagues?
I experienced the real actual sexual harassment and assault when I graduated rescue swimmer school and went to my very first unit as a rescue swimmer. And that was from my immediate supervisor. The other stuff before was more like sexism and gender discrimination. But with this particular individual, this was sexual harassment and assault.
What's the system for reporting that in the Coast Guard?
they have policies, but whether or not they're used the right way, that's a whole different story. But basically, I reported it after a year, and this was a year of basically choosing between the two evils. Do I let him sexually harass me and assault me, or do I try to stand up to this really huge, very intimidating man, and he'll stick me in the office and argue with me for 3 hours and make me cry and then make me feel like crap and then ostracize where nobody talks to me because I'm like the pariah. So then I finally couldn't take it anymore, and I reported it to the command, and he actually got booked on assault, and the commanding officer of the unit told me the next day that I filed, "Don't worry, Sarah, everything, we're going to take care of everything, you're going to be okay." Ha! Little did I know that he actually would go ride Harleys with the person that I filed a sexual harassment claim against, and they would hang out at each other's houses and stuff. So then it just turned into a smear campaign and try to make me look like a terrible performer. And then they actually tried to kick me out for a personality disorder that I was never diagnosed with.
And you say assault because it wasn't just sexual harassment. It wasn't just comments. He was touching you.
Yes, it was. It's technically assault because he would smack my rear really, really hard. And this is in front of the guys in our actual rescue swimmer's shop where we do maintenance on, you know, our gear and stuff like that. And this was actually a good group of guys minus him, but he was extremely intimidating, and he was the senior person besides our chief, and he even intimidated our chief, and the guys would just look down, like shade their eyes. They weren't really in a position to do anything.
Because of the hierarchy.
Exactly. And by the way, the smacking me on the rear is not the only thing. He grabbed me by my head and licked me from my collarbone all the way up the side of my face, and then would just walk away laughing. He would like make me hug him, or he'd get mad at me. He'd just come up to me and sniff me, like nuzzle his face in my neck and say that I put perfume on him. No, I didn't, actually. I just took a shower that day. But he would say that I smelled good for him and stuff. It was just relentless. All of that was completely denied. And I'm getting railroaded, but then I still have to just sit there and have that military decorum while I know what's happening to me. It's so frustrating.
And then you transferred.
Yes.
Time and again, I mean, to California, Alabama, Florida, and I'm wondering, did it get better, or did you just keep running into people like this?
I just kept running into people. A lot of them were friends with that original guy, and so I had broken some sort of bro code, and I was the troublemaker and not to be trusted, and how could you do that to my friend? You know, you hurt my friend, so we're going to hurt you. And then also, I think a lot of it was because I'm only 5'6", you know, blonde hair, blue eyes. I don't look like the typical rescue swimmer, you know. I've always maintained my femininity. I'm proud to be a girl. And I think some of those guys, their ego couldn't handle that. Like, she's blowing our cover. Like, we're supposed to be the biggest, baddest, strongest people here. And then there's little old Sarah doing a search and rescue case in 20-foot waves at night. And they couldn't handle it.
And that supervisor, his name is Albert Amesqua. He's denied the allegations, as have the Coast Guard. What message would you have for him now?
That's a good question. What is my... Oh, you know what my message is? Albie, all you had to do was stop. I actually liked you. I thought you were really funny. You were an awesome boss when you weren't doing all that to me. I didn't want any of this. All you had to do was leave me alone. I wasn't trying to take you out and ruin your career. I just needed you to stop.
Have you found other women within the Coast Guard ranks that you've been able to commiserate with?
100% of the women that I know, the ones that I've had brought this topic up, all of them have. And now that I'm speaking out, they're coming out of the woodwork. And they came up to me crying. And they said, thank you for saying what's happening to us. Thank you for speaking out for us. The world needs to know what happens to women and men.
When you look back on your career, you know, how do you think about it? Because, I mean, you had all that crap to deal with, but you saved lives. You did something amazing.
I had an amazing career. I've been to the South Pole, like the South Pole, not just Antarctica. I've swam at the International Dateline and the Equator. I've landed on an iceberg in a helicopter. I saved lives during Hurricane Katrina. I've done an operational free fall to do a rescue. I've had what we call the dark and stormy. You know, that's the big one where it's like dark and bad waves. And I had all of those boxes checked. I really, really could have done without the other stuff, because it really did some damage to me. And, you know, fighting them, because I knew that I just have a really strong sense of what's right and wrong, or I just have a, I don't know what it is, but I was just not going to let them take it away. And I fought them tooth and nail until it did break me. But I still came out on the other side as, not, I wouldn't say the winner, but they didn't take it away from me. I was always going to retire at 20 years anyway. But yeah, they've forced me out at 20 years.
Sarah, you've been calling on Congress to launch an investigation into the systemic sexual harassment within the Coast Guard. What have you heard from Congress?
They are not happy with what they have heard. The Coast Guard denies that this is a systemic problem, and they'll recite some data from some survey, but none of that matters when there's women and men coming to me and saying, this happened to me too, this happened to me too. Since that article in the Miami Herald came out, I've had a few women tell me that the Coast Guard forced them out for a personality disorder. So that's an MO that they use. And this is all after they filed a sexual harassment claim or an assault claim, not before. How did they make it through boot camp with a personality disorder? Don't you think that those things would have come to the surface before? It's always after. And Congress is, I think they're going to hold their feet to the fire.
Sarah, you're retired now, living in West Palm Beach, and you began work at an animal sanctuary. How did you get involved? Tell me about it.
So it's my friend's farm. Her name is Aurelia, and it's Aurelia's Animal Sanctuary, and it's in Jupiter Farms. A group of wonderful women saved some donkeys that were basically on death's door. And another friend said, Sarah, you need to go help with these donkeys. I think you'll really like it and you'll really love these women. And that was it. So these are horses that were going to be put on a truck and down to Mexico and slaughtered. And she will buy them and, you know, save them. So whenever I can, I go over there and I help her. And it's like animal Shangri-La, so why wouldn't you?
Definitely a very different environment, a lot more peaceful.
Definitely.
Yeah. Let me finish with this. Sarah, what message do you have to young women who consider taking that career path you took?
My message to women who are thinking about doing a job that's traditionally an all-male job, I don't really think it matters what it is. You are going to run into this obstacle that I did. That's just the nature of the beast, unfortunately. And I wish I could say it was different. I wish I could say that we've evolved past this problem, but we haven't. You need to think about whether or not that's worth it to you or not. Like I said, I had an amazing career, but the stuff that happened to me has really messed me up, and I got to work through that. So do you want to go through that as well? Maybe not to the extent I did, but it's something you need to consider for sure.
That was Sarah Faulkner, who spent 2 decades with the U.S. Coast Guard as part of the Elite Swimmer Rescue Team. She was the first and one of only 3 women to ever be part of that team. And during her time, as you heard, she experienced systemic sexual abuse and harassment with the Coast Guard. Again, she's retired and lives in West Palm Beach. And she's battling PTSD now, but she's sharing her story. And you can read more about her story written by the McClatchy's Kevin G. Hall on our social media at WLRN Sundial. For those seeking more resources and support, you can always reach out to the National Sexual Assault Hotline. That's 800-656-HOPE. We reached out to the Coast Guard for comment about her claims of sexual harassment and abuse. We will post their full comments on our website later today at WLRN.org. And I just want to say to Sarah and to everyone who wears the uniform, thank you so much for your service. But to everyone who wears the uniform, you will be held to a higher standard than the rest of us. Having said that, let's switch things up. Still to come, the Marlins back in action after a bunch of their players get COVID. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the Miami Marlins returned to play this week after a long hiatus. This after 18 of their players came down with COVID. Miami Marlins CEO Derek Jeter told the press on Monday that the players just had a false sense of security and they got lax on things like wearing masks. Well, the Marlins' COVID outbreak sent shockwaves through Major League Baseball. Now, 7 players and 6 staff on the St. Louis Cardinals have tested positive. The Miami Herald's Jordan McPherson joins us now to help us understand what's going on. Jordan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on. It's always great to join you guys.
Oh, the team is back in action. They swept the Orioles yesterday, actually, in a doubleheader. But, I mean, first of all, who's playing if all those players have COVID? Who's on the team?
Yeah, that's correct. They had 18 total players who tested positive. All of those players are quarantined in South Florida. They have 13 guys who were with them from opening day who are here. They brought up a handful of guys from their training site in Jupiter. They added, I believe it was 7 or 8 players from the waiver wires through trade, through free agency signings. So they really have this motley crew type of team that's basically up there with them trying to do whatever they can to win ball games.
Now, the players who have COVID, are they back in South Florida?
Yes, that is correct. They all traveled via sleeper buses down to South Florida from Philadelphia. I believe it was on Friday, and they either arrived back in South Florida late Friday or early Saturday, and they're all quarantined down here.
When's the last time professional baseball players had to take a bus? So when and how do they get back? I mean, what has to happen for them to return?
Okay, so according to MLB's operation manuals, which has all of their health and safety protocols and everything related to COVID, they have to produce 2 negative tests at least 24 hours apart, 2 consecutive negative tests, I should add. They have to show no symptoms for at least 72 consecutive hours, and both the team trainer and MLB and an MLB-appointed physician by their joint COVID-19 committee have to clear them to play. which overall would more than likely take somewhere between 2 to 3 weeks from initial infection at a minimum.
How did this happen? Does the league know? Does the team know? I mean, Jeter spoke the other day, but how did you get it's 18 players and 21 people in total that came down with it. How did it happen?
Well, what Derek Jeter said and what seems to be the overall consensus was that players, when they were in Atlanta, they weren't wearing their masks properly. There were some people who were gathering together, whether it was gathering together in the hotel room, masks were down, social distancing wasn't really applied. And really, when you're in such tight quarters like a baseball team is, if one person has it and a couple mistakes here or there happen, we've seen how quickly this virus can spread, and that's what happened here. Jeter did acknowledge that a couple players left the hotel in Atlanta when they were there for exhibition games, but they didn't do anything salacious was the word he used. They didn't go to the bars, they didn't go to restaurants. A couple guys went for a cup of coffee. A couple went to see a teammate, a former teammate who's now in Atlanta, who, as we've reported, that player tested negative, so they don't believe that was a focal point. But it was basically a couple things happened here or there, a couple players got it, and then all of a sudden it spread like wildfire.
Yeah, because it was, late July, and it was the first, there was like two players that got it, that tested positive, then a dozen, and it just kept going from there. And then the league basically had to postpone a bunch of games for the team.
Yeah, it's correct. They had one player who had a positive test turn up on July 24th, which was basically hours before opening day began. It went from 1 to 4 between opening day and 2 days later on their series finale on Sunday. And then it went from 4 to 13 to 17 to 18 to 19. And then it got to the point where MLB said, okay, you guys need to stay quarantined in your hotel in Philadelphia, get the outbreak under control, figure everything out, do whatever you need to do to get this contained and get this figured out, and then we'll worry about getting your season back under control once you have the outbreak under control.
Yeah, and here's the thing. This is a shortened season, 60 games instead of the regular 162. They lost all these games. Are they going to have to make them up, or they just lost those games?
A lot of it's still a work in progress by MLB. The four games that they were supposed to play against the Baltimore Orioles to start last week are the games that are being played now. They fixed that up by being able to play four games in 3 days thanks to the doubleheader yesterday. The other games they lost were three games last weekend at home against the Washington Nationals and the three games they were originally supposed to be playing against the Philadelphia Phillies in Miami Tuesday, yesterday, and today. The good thing about that, at least from a scheduling standpoint, is the Marlins still play the Phillies one more time. They play the Nationals two more times. So potentially you can throw a doubleheader here and there to make up a few of the games. I really don't think they're going to make up all six games combined between the Nationals and the Phillies. And if that happens and they don't play 60 games, the league is going to go by winning percentages to determine their standings. So that's really where the situation's at right now. There's a lot up in the air, but 60 games, it looks unlikely. It's probably going to be more like 57 or 58 for the Marlins, assuming everything else stays under control, which, seeing how it's happened with the league,
yeah, unlikely. And staying under control. I mean, we mentioned St. Louis now has a number of players with COVID. I mean, this is not like the NBA or the other, like the MLS. They're playing in a bubble. They're playing in one city in a bubble. Baseball, they're traveling. Does baseball think that it can get through this season?
Baseball thinks it does, but baseball also understood the risks that were coming into play when they decided to do the traveling schedule. That's why they also realigned the schedule compared to how it normally would have been and try to regionalize everything. That's why the Marlins are only playing East Coast teams, the Cardinals are only playing Central teams, the West Coast is only playing the West Coast. They tried to do that as mitigating factors. They've also enhanced their protocols for road trips and for stuff on game days. Everybody who's not physically on the field has to wear a mask now. It's now mandatory. They're trying to do every other thing they can to try to mitigate and keep this as under control as possible in a situation that you really, truly can't fully control.
Such a strange year. Such a strange year. Jordan McPherson, reporter for the Miami Herald, covering the Marlins. You can find more of his reporting on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Jordan, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Go figure. The Marlins will actually play probably fewer games than everybody else, and they still have a chance to make the playoffs? Unbelievable. Well, that's our program for this Thursday, August 6th. Just a reminder, this month, just want to tell you, we are reading Black Widow by Leslie Gray Streeter, the former Palm Beach Post columnist, details the experience of suddenly losing her husband, raising a foster child, and managing to find humor in all of this. This is part of her new memoir. It's part of our Sundial Book Club for the month of August. Remember, find us on Facebook. Just look up Sundial Book Club. Ask to join. It's free. We'd love to have you. Tell us what you think if you're reading the book. Give us your update. Tell us what you think of the book so far. Also, the primaries are coming up August 18th. Early voting has begun across most of South Florida. It starts in Broward County on Saturday. Get your vote-by-mail ballots in. You have the option, by the way, to bring them to the drop-off location. Just make sure that your signature is on the back. Well, that's our program for this week. Again, thank you so much for listening. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Have a wonderful Friday. Have a great weekend. Stay safe as always. We'll be back live on Monday.